Okay, there you go.
Okay, well, hello everyone. We're post-conference now, so we'll just resume where we left off. We've had to, I think this is the only one of the webinar series that we had to, that we didn't have to suspend. So we will just keep on keeping on. So this is our 67th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. And this webinar series is available on wakara.us under the subheadings Moria Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress as shown here. In July, Dwayne Carpenter will be resuming his series on Awakening the Higher Mind. So you might want to check that out. All episodes of this and the Secret Teachings of All Ages and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com. This month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott is suddenly faced with having to give a lecture on Islam. Could we get a reader, please? You want to start us off, PL?
Yes. Almost as soon as I arrived in Lucknow, I received a shock in the calmly announced fact that the local committee of our branch had engaged that I should give a public lecture the next day on the subject of Islam. I was in a pretty fix when I found out that there was no escape, as the posters and handbills were already issued and the whole Muslim public were to be present. The novelty of a white man being about to lecture in a friendly spirit about the religion was doubtless an irresistible attraction. I could have given the committee a good thrashing, for I had then no more than the slight knowledge of the subject which one gets in the course of his general reading, and I felt very reluctant to speak before so critical an audience as awaited me. Escape being out of the question, however, I borrowed a copy of Saleh's Quran and another Mohammedan book and sat up all night to read them. Here I found the immense advantage of theosophy, for as I read, the key to the exoteric teachings helped me to grasp all that lay between the lines, and light was shed upon the whole system.
Okay, new reader, please.
Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. I think I never before realized so fully its incomparable value as an interpreter of the religious systems. On the entering of the huge Baradari, or Royal Pleasure Hall, I found it packed with an audience which included most of the notable Mohammedans of the place, together with some hundred of educated Hindus. I treated the subject not as a professor of the religion, but as an impartial theosophist to whom the study of all religions is equally interesting and whose chief desire is to get at the truth behind them and boldly announce it without fear or favor. Some good genius must have inspired me, for as I proceeded, I seemed to be able to put myself in Muhammad's place, to translate his thoughts and depict his ideal as though I were a native here and to the manner born. I could see this inspired camel rider incarnating where he did to work out a tremendous karma as the founder of one of the mightiest religious movements in history.
Okay, and finally.
Ann Parker, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. The audience were certainly aroused to a pitch of enthusiasm, for they gave it tumultuous expression. And the next day, a committee waited on me with an address of thanks, in which every blessing of Allah was invoked for me. And the wish was expressed that their children knew 1/10 as much about their religion as I did. Ye gods, how cheaply a reputation is sometimes made. From this experience, I venture to say that an intelligent theosophist is better qualified than any other man to take up the study of any given religion, and will be more likely to get at its inner meaning than the most learned philologist. Thank you. Who has sought the key only in the crypt of his rationalistic mind.
Yeah, so what he means here is that theosophy gives you a more noumenal understanding that substands all the religions. And so even if you're not aware, even if you're not really versed in a religion, when you read about that religion, your intuition will fill in the gaps and you actually understand more about the religion than the practitioners of that religion do, just because you've been given the keys through theosophy. So thank you, Anne. Okay, last time we took a look at two letters from the Master Kurhumi, which addressed the status of Mars and Mercury relative to the Earth scheme. This letter also described the difference between knowledge and wisdom, visible and invisible globes in a chain, the seven chords of universal consciousness called Apollo's heptachord, which, by the way, inspired my conference presentation for this year. We then took a look at the, quote, problem of 777 incarnations, a further treatment of which is found in the Mahatma letters. Then we took a look at the vidyas, which means gnosis, examples of which are the Guhya Vidya, the science of mantras, Mahavidya, the science of magic, and most importantly, Atma Vidya, the true spiritual and divine wisdom. We then began the second of two inserted sections, entitled Additional Facts and Explanations Concerning the Globes and the Monads, which describes the migration from the lunar chain to the Earth chain. Here we learn that there are seven classes or hierarchies of monads that sequentially migrate from one chain to the next. Quote, the appearance of these hierarchies on any one globe are so adjusted that when class 7, the last, appear on globe A, class 1, the first, has just passed on to globe B, and so on, step by step, all round the chain. This key teaching is followed by the statement, again, in the seventh round on the lunar chain, when class 7, the last, quits globe A, that globe, instead of falling asleep as it had done in previous rounds, begins to die, to go into its planetary pralaya. A quick comment on this before we go on. The seventh round is the last passage through the seven globes of a chain. After this passage, these globes sequentially die out. When the final class of monads quits the final globe, that entire chain of globes, quote unquote, dies, or said more accurately, goes into pralaya. But it's a permanent form of pralaya. The beings connected with that move on to other work. The definition of which is covered in the footnote that follows, we're talking about pralaya here, which we also looked at last time, through quotes on the different stages of pralaya from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire and Stanza 1 from The Secret Doctrine. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. So we were in the middle of this new reading. Instead of rereading it, we'll just go right into analyzing it. Excuse me a moment. Since footnote occurs right in the middle of one long sentence, I'm going to reread the sentence in order to regain our context. So again, in the seventh round on the lunar chain, when class seven, the last, quits globe A, that globe, instead of falling asleep as it had done in previous rounds, begins to go into planetary pralaya. And in dying, it transfers successively, as just said, its principles or life elements and energies, etc., one after the other, to a new Laya center, which commences the formation of globe A of the Earth's chain. Okay, so first, this statement confirms that there are indeed seven rounds in a chain, each round with seven globes. Next, we covered this statement last time, but it's important to emphasize that none of the globes of the previous chain are reused in the chain that follows. For each chain represents a higher turn of the spiral and thus develops its own set of globes. So there are 49 globes in a scheme, each visited seven times via the seven rounds of each chain. It can be a little bewildering at first to get this, but eventually you get this. The septenary nature is makes it easier to understand. Next up, and in dying, it transfers successively, as just said, its principles or life elements and energies, etc., one after the other, to a new Laya center, which commences the formation of globe A of the Earth's chain. This is the subject of diagram 2 in the middle of the page here, shown at right. In the transfer from one chain to the next, the Laya center, indicating the transfer of the life wave, is shown by the intermediate encircled 7/1. But since it is a non-physical reality, it doesn't occupy a point in space as it seems to here. Importantly, it says that, let's go back here. This Laya center to a new Laya center, which commences the formation of globe A of the Earth chain. So something takes place in this Laya center that allows for these, the actual formation of the new globe, of the new chain, of the first globe of the new chain, I should say. It's not a completely static condition, even though it is a completely non-physical condition, this Laya center situation here, right? So something is formulated here, you know, on abstract levels that enables this first or globe A or globe one to come into being. Okay. Wait a minute. Sorry. Okay. Next up, our moon was the fourth globe of the series and was on the same plane of perception as our Earth. So, you know, much of this is info HBB has covered already, but you know, repetition never hurts. The Earth and Moon are the only examples of two globe Ds from two different chains that we know of in our solar system. You know, we could speculate that some of the larger moons of the outer planets, you know, may have been globe Ds from their previous chains, but there's no teaching on this anywhere. Also, if they are, then the physical or globe D would have shifted from dense to gaseous, right? Because all the moons are dense, small moons, whereas the globe D's of these outer gas giants are much larger. And so I think it is at least equally possible that the globe D's of the gas giants from previous change have dissipated over the ensuing eons of time. But a third possibility is that the gaseous envelopes from the globe D of the immediately previous chain has dissipated, leaving only the rocky core, which appears to us as one of its moons. Next, by the way, anytime you have any questions, any observations, any thoughts, comments, please, that's what makes this these webinars animated and much more interesting. So, you know, please jump in whenever a thought comes to mind. I know this can be difficult material to engage in, but, the more we do it, the easier it is for everyone to understand.
Okay. And just as you said that, a comment popped up. Sri Yantra Shanti says, isn't Leia the point of Jivatma for the monad, upping in the evolutionary spiral, if that makes sense? And I'm sorry if I butchered the name or any of the words.
Let me look at that. I'll look at the chat myself. Isn't Leia the point of Jivatma for the monad? Well, as I understand, the Jivatma is the vehicle of the monad. So, you know, you could say it's a kind of subjective Jivatma, or Jivatman, as it is sometimes called. And, you know, you could say it's a reestablishing of that higher vehicle for the new chain that's coming into being. So yeah, I like this idea. Thank you for that. Anyone else?
Nope, not so far.
Okay. Okay, next up, but globe A of the lunar chain is not fully dead till the first monads of the first class have passed from globe G or Z, the last of the lunar chain, into the nirvana which awaits them between the two chains. So, you know, the thing that determines whether they're dead or not is the life forms, the actual monadic presence on these globes. So when the last when the last monads have passed from a globe, that's when all the life force has exited, and that globe then goes into pralaya. So it's an important point. The first of the seven globes doesn't truly die until the leading group of monads vacates the moon chain and enters nirvana, the Laya center between the two chains. And finally, we have, and similarly for all the other globes, as stated, each giving birth to the corresponding globe of the Earth chain. So the transfer continues, right? As you see here. That is not a plus sign, by the way. That's a symbol for the Earth. That's what that means. So a globe from one chain, quote unquote, gives birth to its corresponding globe through passage of the monadic life waves from one chain to the next. This would also bring forth the next iteration of the planetary logos. I'm sure there's a deeply occult process whereby the globe of a new chain is consecrated and thus made ready to receive the first monadic life wave from the previous chain. I saw a hand.
Yes, Lisa's got her hand up. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yes, Francis, I just wanted to say that, first of all, I've been watching your videos, even though I haven't been attending, so I'm trying to jump in and attend. But I'm really appreciating that you're using Sinnott's work here first, because when I've examined other texts by Powell, by Ledbetter, Sinnott's work reads really differently. And to me, it's the much more accurate work, and it's the work that Blavatsky is primarily referring to.
That's
and to reemphasize, especially what you just said, in those others, it looks like you go from globe A, B, C, D, E, F, G, E, F, I think G, and then you go back A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And what Sinnott says that you just read that's so important is A goes to B. And then B starts up. I mean, it gets very complicated, but that they don't go in this one round A through G, another round A through G. They go A to B, and then B to C, et cetera, et cetera. And when I illustrated this in a video, I animated the whole thing.
Oh, cool.
It was really mind-blowing to me, because suddenly I could see how as one comes into manifestation, especially at globe D, which is the physical dense, how it in a way starts to eat up or take out of incarnation. So if you look at what Francis has there, for example, he has A, B, C, D that everybody's looking at. And yeah, let's just say this one's a little confusing. Yeah, go over to D. Now D, E, F, G, where Francis, your arrow just was, is going out of incarnation. So in the animation using Sinnott, you see something going into incarnation and then out of incarnation as others come into incarnation. I think I'm probably confusing everything. Versus in the others.
It's a very hard thing to talk about because, the language that we have to use to get it. Once you have an understanding of this, it seems much simpler than the language you have to use to describe it. It's just one of the funny things about this, So
and that's why I animated the whole thing.
Yeah, that's useful.
Visually see them coming in and out,
yeah,
and going into the pralaya. But anyway, my main point is, Sinnott is the main source to rely upon. That's my main point.
Well, I would update that and say actually HPB is a better source than Sinnott. Right.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
What happened was, Sinnott studied under the same master as Colonel Olcott and HPB, the Master Kuthumi, who was in India at the time, and they exchanged letters. And, HPB and Olcott often stayed with Sinnott in their travels around India, when they were teaching. And, he was certainly a high initiate. His work reads that way. It feels authoritative. After his publications, which are in the mid-80s, more information was given out by the masters. So their HPB does update Sinnott. The whole first addendum in the secret doctrine here that we're just finishing, that whole first section talked a lot about updating Sinnott, but he was primarily correct in his assertions. He did definitely had the stamp of the master's approval. So yeah, thank you, Lisa.
Yes, and thank you for that. And I agree with that. I was just referring to if people want to stray off into Powell or Ledbetter. Thank you.
Oh, right. Yeah, and they were published really much later. I share the opinion that you have to read them with a grain of salt. You want to corroborate and use them in relation. Another one you could add to that mix is De Peruker, who is also can be hit and miss in terms of this. But there's some interesting information in all three of those additional sources. But I agree that Sinnott, like Annie Besant, and it's Besant, not Besant, Are the primary recommended sources outside of HBB herself? Okay, yeah. So let's see. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Sure. Lisa, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. You want me to start with further?
Right.
Further, when globe A of the new chain is ready, the first class or hierarchy of monads from the lunar chain incarnate upon it in the lowest kingdom, and so on successively. The result of this is that it is only the first class of monads which attains the human state of development during the first round, since the second class on each planet arriving later has not time to reach that stage. Thus, the monads of class two reach the incipient human stage only in the second round, and so on up to the middle of the fourth round. But at this point, and on this fourth round in which the human stage will be fully developed, the door into the human kingdom closes. And henceforward, the number of human monads, i.e. monads in the human stage of development, is complete. For the monads, which had not reached the human stage by this point, will, owing to the evolution of humanity itself, find themselves so far behind that they will reach the human stage only at the close of the seventh and last round. They will, therefore, not be men on this chain, but will form the humanity of a future Manvantara and be rewarded by becoming men on a higher chain altogether, thus receiving their karmic compensation. To this, there is but one solitary exception, for very good reasons, of which we shall speak farther on, but this accounts for the difference in the races.
Thank you, Lisa. Okay, so first up, further, when globe A of the new chain is ready, remember that it is made ready in that intermediate Laya condition. The first class of hierarchy of monads from the lunar chain incarnate upon it in the lowest kingdom, and so on successfully. This takes us back to page 159, where we learned that man, or rather that which becomes man, passes through all the forms and kingdoms during the first round, and through all the human shapes during the two following rounds. It would seem that it is necessary for the first wave of monads migrating from one chain to the next to recapitulate all the lower kingdoms of nature. Possibly this is in order to actually construct the noumenal form aspect of these kingdoms for the subsequent waves of monads that will be inhabiting them. So it's a very particular purpose, this recapitulation of the lower kingdoms in nature. Next, the result of this is that it is only the first class of monads which attains the human state of development during the first round, since the second class on each planet arriving later has not time to reach that stage. Thus, the monads of class two reach the incipient human stage only in the second round, and so on up to the middle of the fourth round. So, to extend this progression, possibly the third wave of monads would reach the human stage during the third round, and some of the fourth wave monads would reach the human stage before the door closes, as we discover in this next passage. But at this point, and on this fourth round in which the human stage will be fully developed, the door into the human kingdom closes, and henceforward, the number of human monads, that is, monads in the human stage of development, is complete. So cosmically speaking, this is a very recent event, for the door only closed on the animal kingdom during the Atlantean root race at which time the last wave of animal men were individualized. There was a much greater individualization in Lemurian times, but some were let in at the time of Atlantis. Could we get a reader for this passage, please?
Susan? Oops, I guess we lost Susan. Okay. Tom, can you read that for us, please?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
During the third root race, animal individualization took place and the self-conscious unit called man came into being. In this chain, individualization took place during the third root race and in the fourth round. In the fourth root race, the door, as it is called, between the two kingdoms became closed, and no more of the animal kingdom passed into the human. The cycle temporarily ended, and to express it in terms of fire or of electrical phenomena, the animal kingdom and the human became positive to each other, and repulsion instead of attraction supervened. All this was brought about by the swinging into power of a profoundly long cycle of the fifth ray. This was necessitated by the need of man to develop along the Manasic line and resulted in a period of repulsion of the animal units, leaving their consciousness to be stimulated on astral lines.
So you can see how bringing in this prolonged period of fifth ray influence would polarize the animal kingdom away from the human kingdom, right? Literally creating this double positive polarity so that you would have this repulsion between them. And that really would be the energy behind the closing of the door. Right, Scott. Fascinating how this the rays are used in order to forward the purpose. Right,
Francis.
Yeah.
And Veronica says, "So, are we now on the fifth root race?"
We are indeed. We are in the Aryan root race, the purpose of which is the development of the mental sheath of mind. And for initiates, disciples, to move into consciousness on the higher three subplanes of the mental plane. All that is only possible because of the influences brought forward in this fifth root race. Notice the numbers, you know, fifth ray, fifth root race, fifth plane of mind, all working together to stimulate mind for us. Okay, so next up. Oh, I see my hand. Yeah.
Yep. Go ahead, Gordon.
Hi. When we're talking about these other rounds, the first round, they reach incipient human stage, and second round, is that talking about individualization there?
No, there's no individualization. In fact, later on, she talks about how, you know, we only call them humankind for convenience sake because they're so ethereal. They at that stage, they weren't even part in the first round, at least. They weren't even part of the 3D spatial. The environment of the first round was not one of 3D space. It was more noumenal than that. So clearly there were no bodies at all as we know them. You know, even things like astral and mental sheaths had not formed yet. And no one goes further that I've found in describing the condition of humanity at this level, but it definitely wasn't individualized. The reason being that is very specifically a function of of concretization, right? So it's necessary for this to happen on a fourth round, fourth globe situation. So, yes, I hope that helps.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And then Janet's got her hand up. Go ahead, Janet.
Yes, you're talking about the repulsion. With the animals, and that's to further to develop their astral sheaths.
And right.
To do what? Do we know the purpose? See there are animals and our pets, obviously, but you know,
that's right. And I mean, you know, anybody who has a pet, unless it's a goldfish, knows about, you know, the fact that your pets are developing their emotional response. You know, they are very much developing along that line, and just a touch in the incipient stage of mental awareness, right? You could call it kama manas, with almost all the emphasis on the kama aspect, right? And so they are in process of developing that sheath. If you have a pet, you know what I'm talking about, you know, cat or dog. The door will open again, but it won't be until the next chain that the door once again opens, because as she just said, the door is closed not only for this globe, but for this entire series of rounds, right? If you don't make it in by the fourth globe or the fourth round, the entire chain is closed, all right? So they all have to wait through a number of globe incarnations, you know, because each round there's seven globes. So in the fifth round, which is the next one to come, there'll be seven globes. Still no individualization. It's closed for this whole time. Then the sixth, then the seventh, and then a new chain comes into being. And during that chain, the door will once again open. But that is an eternity from now before that opens, you know. So we talk a little bit more about that later. Anyone else?
Yes, Anne Veronica's got her hand up. Go ahead, Anne Veronica.
Yes, hello. I'm probably asking something basic, but when we're talking about individualization, we're talking that we are given a soul and a solar angel and the angel of the presence. Am I right?
That's exactly right. Right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that basic idea up. You know, it's normally on this globe, it's associated with Lemurian times, you know, at which point there was the door was open between animal man and humanity. And those who crossed, there was an acquiescence by the soul, kingdom of souls. And there was that overshadowing which characterizes humanity began at that point. So that event is called individualization and is considered to be among the very greatest of our initiations, because it is a kind of initiation in its own right.
It wasn't always that way. It's something that came to be to help humanity grow faster, evolve faster. Am I right?
Yeah, conditions were set up way in advance in order to stimulate humankind right at that period of the fourth, fifth subrace of the Lemurian race that allowed that to occur. It happened, for instance, during a Leo cycle, which is the time, you know, Leo always has to do with development of consciousness and the sense of self. And so it was a natural period for this to occur. So yeah, there was, exact moment in the exact time for this event to occur, which would have all been designed in advance. Okay, anyone else?
Thank you, Francis. I was thinking, because I'm reading Rays and Initiations, what Michael's talking about and about the Antakarana and all those things, and it suddenly dawned on me, this individualization is kind of an Antakarana, but the top.
Yes, it is. Because, but you know, it's always both ways. You know, there has to be a participation. So that's it is. Antakarana is also a very general term. You know, we tend to apply it to.
As far as I understood, in Lemurian times, they had to form their own Antakarana, build the body with the bridge the body with the etheric body, and then at Atlantia times, the Antakarana was to bridge the etheric body with the astral body, and now we have to do this with our mental body, and so on. So it's a very general term.
Yeah, it can be a very it's a specific term. You know, as detailed on page, something like page 430 in Rays and Initiations, for like 130 pages, he talks about the specific five steps of building the Antakarana. And that's very specifically on that bridges the higher mental to connect with the mental permanent atom. But it's also, as you say, a general term, and to bridge the cleavages that exists and characterize each root race. So in Lemurian times, that cleavage was between the physical and the etheric body that was bridged. And in Atlantean times, the effort was made to bridge, to heal the cleavage between the physical, etheric, and the astral body. It wasn't entirely successful, which is why you have so many emotionally polarized people on the planet now. And then the goal for the Aryan race is to heal that final cleavage between the astral and the mental body, which leads to the integrated personality. And it's only the integrated personality that can then begin building the Antakarana proper, you know, between the mental unit and the monastic permanent atom. So, yeah. Good comments. Thank you, Donald. Yeah.
And then Lisa has her hand up.
Yes, Lisa.
Could you repeat, Francis, your definition of individualization so I don't have to wait to rewatch it in the video?
Yeah, sure. It was this great event that allows the bridging between the animal and the human kingdom, also between animal man, which is a form that of course no longer exists, and humankind. And this is done by the acquiescence of the soul to overshadow an individual human being. Of course, it's the entire kingdom of souls that overshadows the entire kingdom of humanity. But it is that particular event, that willingness or that acquiescence of the soul stimulate the sheaths of the new human that actually creates the fourth kingdom. And that event is called individualization. Okay, anybody else? All right, so next, for the monads which had not reached the human stage by this point will, owing to the evolution of humanity itself, find themselves so far behind that they will reach the human stage only at the close of the seventh and last round. They will therefore not be men on this change. I see, okay. But will form the humanity of a future Manvantara and be rewarded by becoming men on a higher chain altogether, thus receiving their karmic compensation. So this is interesting. I'm seeing something that I hadn't seen before, which is they will reach the human stage only at the close of the seventh and last round. But because it's at the close of we're on chain four now. So they will reach the human stage, you know, the animal kingdom will reach the human stage at the very close of the last round of seven planets, probably literally the last planet. And they will therefore not be men on this chain. So there'll be no opportunity to actually incarnate and develop within the human kingdom, even though technically they actually do reach the human stage at the close of the seventh and last round. That's just, you know, a fascinating detail I hadn't noticed before. So if you've been thinking that Spot or Fluffy will make it into the human kingdom anytime soon, HPB is suggesting otherwise. You know, you want to break the news slowly to your favorite pet. DK gives us more info on individualization in the coming chains. But before we read this, I'll take that raised hand.
Okay, Gordon, please go ahead.
Yes. So it is said that some of our humanity did actually individualize on the moon chain.
Oh, yeah.
The rest of it individualized here.
Correct.
But from what you just read, saying that no animals on our chain now will actually individualize on this chain. Is that right?
Right. So, yes, there was an earlier wave that individualized on the complete previous chain. In fact, it's serendipitous that the illustration is up. So here's the previous chain, third chain, right? Our fourth chain here, right? So there were those who individualized on the third chain. In fact, we'll learn about that a little bit in this quote. And therefore came in as human beings on this fourth chain, right? But those that, and those would be those lunar petries, that first wave of human monads, also the second wave, remember, because they also made it, and the third wave, you know, because they individualized on the first chain, the first wave, even though they had to recapitulate through all the kingdoms, then the even though it took them all seven rounds in order to finally become men on that first chain, and then the second wave of monads individualized on the second chain, the third on the third, she doesn't say that, but we can assume that that's true, especially because we also have teaching that we have moon chain individualized human beings, right? And then the two groups, mostly the Lemurians on our fourth chain, and then a few also who individualized in Atlantis. And that's kind of the whole group of individualization. So those that didn't make it through on this globe by now, you could say, you know, on this globe of this fourth chain, fourth globe, the doors closed through the rest of this entire chain, right? That means the fifth round, globes A through G, the sixth round, globes A through G, and the seventh round, globes A through G, right? But then they do, she says here, make it into the human condition at the end of the seventh round, but won't incarnate as human beings until the fifth chain. It's fascinating teaching. I hope I answered your question.
Yes. Another question is about the term lunar petries.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying
they're lunar petries because they became men on the lunar chain, which is also called the Saturn chain, the third chain anyway.
Okay, so that's what the term lunar petries refers
to. Well, no, the lunar petries come out of that body. We're actually going to be reading about them in just a minute, so I'll just hold on that, okay?
Okay.
The slide is coming. I have a slide coming up dedicated to a definition of lunar petries.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, so could we get a reader for this short read?
Gordon, would you like to read that for us?
Okay. On the moon chain, individualization took place during the fifth race of the third round. And in the next chain to ours on the evolutionary arc, individualization will take place during the sixth race of the second round. In each case, this refers to a planetary round through a chain of globes.
Okay, pop quiz. Notice anything missing in this explanation? What's missing? DK gives us the round and the race, but not the globe. Does this mean that individualization always takes place on globe D, or that the info as to which globe is a secret of initiation somehow? And it's interesting. I read this two or three times before I noticed that information wasn't present, right? Fifth race, third round. And on our next, in the next chain, that was on the third chain. It happened in the fifth race of the third round. But no globe. And in the next chain, it'll take place during the sixth race of the second round, but no globe. I thought it would be curious. So, you know, either it's always the fourth globe or there's a blind here. There's purposely information left out. And, you know, DK isn't as big into blinds or deletions of information as is HPB, because more was allowed by the time DK came around. Okay. Finally, we have the cryptic statement. To this, there is but one solitary exception, for very good reasons, of which we shall speak farther on. But this accounts for the difference in the races. One solitary exception as to who can pass or has passed through the door of individualization into the human kingdom. Could some particular animal type passing through the door have accounted for the racial differences? You know, it's a provocative question, you know. We'll have to hold off on our speculation until HPB later addresses this subject. Unless, of course, the answer to this just suddenly flashes in your mind. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Cindy, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. It thus becomes apparent how perfect is the analogy between the processes of nature in the cosmos and in the individual man. The latter lives through his life cycle and dies, his higher principles corresponding in the development of a planetary chain to the cycling monads pass into Devachan, which corresponds to the nirvana in states of rest intervening between two chains. The man's lower principles are disintegrated in time and are used by nature again for the formation of new human principles. And the same process takes place in the disintegration and formation of worlds. Analogy is thus the surest guide to the comprehension of the occult teachings. This is one of the seven mysteries of the moon, and it is now revealed. The seven mysteries are called by the Japanese Yamabusis, the mystics of the Laotaz sect, and the ascetic monks of Kyoto. the Denzin Odo, the seven jewels. Only the Japanese and the Chinese Buddhist ascetics and initiates are, if possible, even more reticent in giving out their knowledge than are the Hindus. But the reader must not be allowed to lose sight of the monads and must be enlightened as to their nature as far as permitted without trespassing upon the highest mysteries of which the writer does not in any way pretend to know the last or final word.
Thank you. Okay, first a statement lauding the principle of as above, so below, paralleling the passage of the cycling monads to into Devachan and the nirvana between chains. So, you know, the same principles hold, whether you're talking about a globe or a human monad cycling in and out of incarnations, right? And the same laws govern the dissolution of substance and the reformation of that dissolved substance into new vehicles, right? Next, the man's lower principles are disintegrated in time and are used by nature again for the formation of new human principles. And the same process takes place in the disintegration and formation of worlds. Analogy is thus the surest guide to the comprehension of the occult teachings. When soul withdraws its consciousness, the lower sheaths of a human being disintegrate, and the little lives of the seventh hierarchy, called the breadbasket of nourishment, reform into new sheaths under the impetus of the sixth hierarchy, called by DK the greater builders. When the planetary logos withdraws its consciousness at the end of a chain, disintegration likewise sets in, and the matter of the old chain is likewise reformed into the globes of the new by these seven same hierarchies. Substance is substance, whether that of a human sheath or that of the sheath of a globe. Okay, next. This is
Anne Veronica asks, so we can have disintegration of the monads at some time?
Only of the vehicles of the monads, not of the monad itself, because there is no form aspect specifically to the monads. This is a big question that she gets into in depth, but in this first generation theosophy, the monad was considered to be Atmabuddhi, which is a combination of the monadic essence and the highest sheath for that essence to demonstrate through, right? Well, any sheath eventually disintegrates, you know, so in that case, you could say that the sheath of the monadic essence eventually, you know, like all else, cycles and is reborn in a higher version of itself, right? But that the monadic essence is really one with the universal monad, and has no form life. So wherever you see, you know, a conditional monad, like, you know, for instance, the fourth hierarchy of human monads, it's used for convenience sake. It's the true monadic essence is universal, and that informs the sheaths that exist in the fourth hierarchy, for instance, for human monads. Anyone else?
Yes. Oh, Anne Veronica says that's the spiritual triad.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it took me a minute to relate it, but that's exactly right. You always have three aspects, which condition manifestation, right? The monadic aspect, as an essence, is beyond, it's the unifying principle of the triad. It's the synthesis of it and precedes it. you know, it's noumenal to it, and its first demonstration in form is to demonstrate through its three aspects, right? Okay, so next up, this is one of the seven mysteries of the moon, and it is now revealed. The seven mysteries are called by the Japanese Yamabusis, the mystics of the Lao Tse sect, and the ascetic monks of Kyoto, the Zenodo, the seven jewels. Only the Japanese and the Chinese Buddhist ascetics and initiates are, if possible, even more reticent in giving out their knowledge than are the Hindus. So let's read about the Japanese Yamabushi from the Theosophical Glossary. Can we get a reader for this, please? They still exist today. Here you can see one. Three.
Catherine, can you read that for us, please?
Yamabushi, a sect in Japan of ancient origin, but now inclining to Buddhism. Often regarded as the fighting monks, inasmuch as they have not hesitated to take up arms in case of necessity, somewhat like certain yogis in Rajputana or the lamas in Tibet. They are perhaps most numerous near Kyoto, where they are famed for their healing powers. Yamabushi hold a, quote, Japanese secret science of the Buddhist mystics, end quote, calling their seven mystery teachings the seven precious things or jewels.
Thank you. So in Buddhism, there are seven precious jewels that stand for faith, insight, meditative absorption, joy, diligence, mindfulness, and equanimity. But since, one, these are not apparently related to the moon, and two, considering the Yamabushi's reticence to reveal their secrets, these seven jewels are very possibly, well, blinds or the outer garment of a deeper teaching. You know, if we go back to this quote, it says here, calling their seven mystery teachings, right? So there's something going on here that is unrevealed, and HPB hints at that. Okay, next up, a review of the three classes of monads. And we're talking about, you know, these life waves that come sequentially. And the first class of monad being the first to transfer that life wave. So can we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The monadic host may be roughly divided into three great classes. One, the most developed monads, the lunar gods or spirits, called in India the Pitris, whose function it is to pass in the first round through the whole triple cycle of the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdom in the most ethereal, filmy, and rudimentary form, in order to clothe themselves in and assimilate the nature of the newly formed chain. There are those who first reach the human form, if there can be any form in the realm of the almost subjective, on globe A in the first round. It is they, therefore, who lead and represent the human element during the second and third round, and finally evolve their shadows at the beginning of the fourth round, for the second class or those who come behind them. Two, those monads that are the first to reach the human stage during the 3.5 rounds and to become men. Three, logods, the monads which are retarded and which will not reach by reason of karmic impediment the human stage at all during this cycle or round, save one exception, which will be spoken of elsewhere as already promised.
Thank you. So, the first group, we're here reminded, are the lunar Pitris. Lunar because they came from the moonshine. And here's that reference I was talking about before to the lunar petries. Could we get a reader, please?
Sure, I'll read it. Lunar petries, from the Sanskrit Peter, father, ancestor. Lunar fathers, also called Barhishad Petries and lunar ancestors, used in distinction from the solar Petries or Agnishattvas. Lunar Petries are the actual progenitors of our lower principles, as distinguished from the Dhyani Chohans, who are, in an important sense, our own selves. Lunar Petries, in the wider sense, come from the moon chain to inform the earth chain, forming a sevenfold or tenfold hierarchy. In a more restrictive sense, they are those elements in our constitution which are below the evolutionary standards of the Agnishattvas. I don't say that right, but I'm sorry. Informing our lower principles, whereas the solar petries, originating not in the moon chain, but in the higher sphere, give to man the higher parts of his constitution. There is a subdivision of the seven classes of lunar petries into arupa, formless, and rupa, form. The lunar petries built a cycle physical vehicle fit for the informing intellectual spirit, which the Agnishvatas communicated.
All right. Thank you, Beale. We also learn here that the, so let's see if there's anything in this. Yeah, I think we covered it. We also learn here that the reason the lunar petries recapitulate the lower kingdoms is, quote, in order to clothe themselves in and assimilate the nature of the newly formed chain. This only happens once on a chain, when this first wave of monads transfers onto globe A. Apparently, this recapitulation in some mysterious but essential way activates the forms needed by these lower kingdoms, and thus opens the way for the monadic waves that follow. It's important to understand that the lunar petries are intrinsically at a much higher level of consciousness than the kingdoms that they are setting in motion through their recapitulation. I mean, we get from this that they're, that the purpose is to see, where is it? He said, which is to enliven, activate, reinitiate those elements in our constitution which are below the evolutionary standard of the solar beings, the Agnishvatas, right? They inform our lower principles, but that's also true on the globe itself, that they somehow, it's very mysterious and interesting, that they actually bring into form, they inform the lower principles of the new globe. Okay. The statement, and finally evolve their shadows at the beginning of the fourth round for the second class or those who come behind them, suggests that the shadows, which are the lower three human she's, are conditioned by the lunar ancestors with qualities unique to the new earth chain. And again, see, it's in the Laya center between chains where the new quality of vibration is determined, right? But it's actually instituted by this first wave of monads called the lunar ancestors or lunar petries. So, and again, we have the idea that this first wave of monads somehow makes possible habitation of the lower she's for the monadic waves that follow. So it's not just that they're first, you know, it's not just the first, they do the thing and the second come along. They have this very particular task of rebirthing the form aspect on the new, in the new chain, on that, the first globe of the new chain. Next, HPB references the second wave of monads. So let's take a look at the footnote, which this references here, and to become men. She's talking about the nature of men in this. Could we get a reader, please?
Ann Parker, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. We are forced to use here the misleading word men, and this is a clear proof of how little any European language is adapted to express these subtle distinctions. It stands to reason that these men did not resemble the men of today, either in form or nature. Why then, it may be asked, call them men at all? Because there is no other term in any Western language which approximately conveys the idea intended. The word men at least indicates that these beings were manus, thinking entities, however they differed in form and intellection from ourselves. But in reality, they were, in respect of spirituality and intellection, rather gods than men. The same difficulty of language is met with in describing the stages through which the monad passes. Metaphysically speaking, it is, of course, an absurdity to talk of the development of a monad or to say that it becomes man. But any attempt to preserve metaphysical accuracy of language in the use of such a tongue as the English would necessitate at least three extra volumes of this work and would entail an amount of verbal repetition which would be wearisome in the extreme. It stands to reason that a monad cannot either progress or develop or even be affected by the changes of states it passes through. It is not of this world or plane, and may be compared only to an indestructible star of divine light and fire thrown down onto our earth as a plank of salvation for the personalities in which it indwells. It is for the latter to cling to it, and thus partaking of its divine nature, obtain immortality. Left to itself, the monad will cling to no one, but like the plank, be drifted away to another incarnation by the unresting current of evolution.
Thank you, Anne. So we're not going to analyze this footnote line by line, but there are a few interesting points here. First, the word men at least indicates that these beings were manus, thinking entities. However, they differed in form and intellection from ourselves. So when used in the singular, the term manu is interchangeable with the term lunar ancestor. But manu also stands for humanity as a collective, emphasizing that which demonstrates manas. And finally, the manu is, as we know, one of the three offices of the hierarchy and represents the prototype, the perfect man of a given root race. Next, HPB points out that a monad neither progresses nor develops on its own plane, but rather sends forth a shadow of itself, the soul slash personality, in order to redeem the lesser lives which make up its various she's. And that it is this shadow that progresses and develops on its return journey to reunion with its own true self. This is one of the fundamental tenets of theosophy. But the idea that a monad, we talked about this before a little bit, but it comes up again. The idea that a monad neither progresses nor develops goes against another theosophical tenet, which states that all manifested forms of consciousness are in process of evolution. All we have to do is look at the midway position of the hierarchy of human monads to see that it is, like all else, in process of being drawn up through the law of attraction by the hierarchies above it. You can see here that's fourth, being drawn up by the third. Just as it acts to draw up the three hierarchies beneath it. Now, to her credit, HPV does earlier state there must be a limited number of monads evolving and growing more and more perfect through their assimilation of many successive personalities in every new Manvantara. The key phrase here being evolving and growing more and more perfect. This said, and as we'll learn later in the text, the one universal monad, which includes all lesser monads within itself, does remain unchanged because it embodies all conditional change. Thoughts or questions about anything in this footnote? Okay, back to the text where we take up a consideration of the third group, the laggards.
Okay, you got a hand up.
Yeah, let's go for that.
Go ahead, Anne Veronica.
Francis, I didn't understand in the paragraph we read, were they evolved? On one paragraph, it says that they were thinking beings, but on another paragraph, it said they were rather gods than men. That's mean highly evolved, but they are descending. What's going on here?
Yeah, they're rather gods because they began on the higher subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, but they're definitely on an involutional arc going down. They aren't gods in the sense of those who have gone all the way into matter, become individualized, and then gone up through all the initiations to be re-identified or reunion with Godhead, but rather are in that initial state of deity before the descent, right?
There are two arcs. They are the left arc coming down, and they haven't done yet the right arc going back to the monad.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. But may I ask still something else?
Yeah, of course.
I will open. A subject. But the monads aren't they? Don't they come from the solar angels? Isn't the coming down of the solar angels that put the monads on the higher plane of our cosmic physical plane, and then they come down and they become the angel of the presence at our soul? So can we say that the solar angels are the monads also? Or they have the essence of what we call the monad in them?
Yes, they do. The solar angels on their own plane are great beings who live in the heart of the sun. They acquiesce, that is, they agree to become the souls of humankind, right? In that position, they stand as the relational factor, the intermediary between the true self, the monad, on the monadic plane, and the personality. And in that role, they have their presence on the higher mental subplanes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Yes, Janet, go ahead.
So this might be a little off the topic, but I was thinking about the conference and when we were talking about the stages from clear audience to a higher clear audience going on. Is that what's going on between the solar angel and ourselves?
That's the means by which we begin to gain connection. So, you know, clear audience is just an astral form of hearing, and it's not inherently spiritual. Higher clear audience, however, is what makes possible the hearing of the voice of the silence. That's mental plane hearing, higher clairaudience, right? And as such, it allows us to be impressed by the voice of the silence. So on that sense of hearing, that's one of the methods by which we link with the soul.
You
can also make lines of connection through the other senses. You know, for instance, the sense of taste has imagination on the astral plane and discrimination on the mental plane, and finally intuition on the Buddhic plane. So that sense is also very, very important in the development of soul connection. Anyone else?
Yeah, hold on. Let me get it up. Sri Yantra Shanti says, so the solar angels are, in fact, the Laya point between the human and the monad individually and grouply?
Well, I wouldn't call them a Laya point. Laya is very specific to, I mean, in terms of it being an intermediary, I understand what you're saying. But Laya or Laya is very much connected with a pralaya, which means that place of non-manifestation. And in fact, the soul is the source of our manifestation. So it's like it in the sense that it acts as an intermediary between our essential self, the true self of the monad, and the shadow, the personality self. Anyone else? Okay. So the laggards, the monads which are retarded and which will not reach by reason of karmic impediments the human stage at all during this cycle or round, this cycle or round of seven globes, right? This includes the monads of all the subhuman kingdoms, right? One wonders how, since this group has yet to enter the fourth kingdom, they could have accrued karmic impediments, right? Which by reason of karmic impediment. So how did they accrue karmic impediments if they weren't human? Well, possibly this is a group, kingdom, or even a planetary karma that has affected this group called the laggards. Yes, Gordon, I see your hand.
All right, go ahead, Gordon.
Yes, so it's class one, the most developed monads.
Mm-hmm.
Are those ones who have gone through the evolution through a human form and pass on to higher states, or are those ones just starting that?
No, the first stage are the ones who activate the new globe on a new chain. They recapitulate the lower kingdoms of nature, and by the end of the first round, right, the first round of seven globes, they've become human beings, right? Then, having activated all those form aspects for them, the second wave comes along and becomes the humanity of the second round, right? But at that point, of course, the first round humanity is continuing to progress, you know, because they have this head start of an entire round, which is seven globes. That's 49 root races, you know, that they have an advantage over that second wave. But nonetheless, the second wave come through, become humanity on the second round. Third wave, she doesn't say it directly, but she says, and so on. So we could assume that the third wave becomes human beings on the third round. And then you have this fourth wave, which stops at mid-round. where the door is closed. So that involves the first and the second groups that I just described, right? First group is are the progenitors, the lunar pregeries that reactivate everything. The second group are those who reach human stage during the first 3.5 rounds to become human beings. It's the laggards who don't become humans at all during this cycle or round. Is that clear? Take some repetition to get it.
So we said in the first round, they weren't going through individualization. So, and they already achieved some kind of individualization then, and they're just going through and creating the forms that the others will pass through.
If we go back to, let's see here, I want to find this particular image. It was a ways back, yeah. Okay, where am I now? I just don't want to get lost here. Okay, 67. If we go back here to individualization took place on the moon chain, the previous chain, you know, during the fifth race in the third round. So we might assume from this, see, he only goes back one, here, let me go back into, no, I won't. He only goes back one chain, but we might assume from this that of some form of individualization takes place on the previous chains. That is not discussed. It's a good point to bring up. But she also just said, let's see, where are we here? Sorry, guys. Gotta find my place. Oh, we're not. Oh, I went too far ahead. Here we are. Okay. Yeah, it also says right here, the word men at least indicates these beings, we're talking about this first wave, were manus, thinking entities, however they differed in form of intellection from ourselves. This, to me, indicates that there had to be some form of individualization, even on that first chain. Okay. But, you know, we suffer from a lack of information here. All we can do is kind of piece together what we have. So we have that DK quote where he tells us that, you know, on the moon chain, that men individualized on such and such a round and root race, and that on the next one it'll be in another round and root race. So from that we know that it happens, that it does happen on other chains. From this we might gather that there is a form of individualizing that takes place, right? By the end of the seventh round of the first chain, human beings have become individualized. I'm going to posit that as a reality, but you know, it's difficult to say unequivocally because I haven't run across any teaching on it. Okay.
I realize that some of the stuff we don't have the real teaching on, so we just have to use our own intuition about it.
Yeah, and what you do is, you know, like that phrase that I just looked at, you know, the fact that they have an intellection, this, you know, first wave of humans on that first round, that suggests to me that term intellection suggests to me that there was individualization taking place. It's just never stated in so many words. And, you know, what I always do with this is I just hold these questions up, and then very often, sometime way, way down the line, you'll get an answer through one source or another, you know, or at least a little more intuition, a little more information that might lead to more understanding. That's all we can do.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Okay. Could we get a reader, please?
Sure. Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Now the evolution of the external form or body round, the astral, is produced by the terrestrial forces, just as in the case of the lower kingdoms. But the evolution of the internal or real man is purely spiritual. It is now no more a passage of the impersonal monad through many and various forms of matter, endowed at best with instinct and consciousness on quite a different plane, as is the case of external evolution, but a journey of the pilgrim soul through various stages, states of not only matter, but self-consciousness and self-perception, or a perception from the aperception, apperception. See gods, monads, and atoms. The monad emerges from a state of spiritual and intellectual unconsciousness and skipping the first two planes, too near the absolute to permit of any correlation with anything on a lower plane, it gets direct into the plane of mentality. But there is no place in the whole universe with a wider margin or a wider field of action in its almost endless gradations of perception, perceptive and apperception qualities than this plane, which in its turn, an appropriate smaller plane for every form from the mineral monad up to the time when that monad blossoms forth by evolution into the divine monad. But all the time, it is still one and the same monad, differing only in its incarnations. Throughout its ever succeeding cycles of partial or total obscuration of spirit, or the partial or total obscuration of matter, two polar antitheses. As it ascends into the realms of mental spirituality or descends into the depths of materiality.
Thank you, Janet. So there's a lot here in this two paragraphs. So first up, now the evolution of the external form or body round the astral is produced by the terrestrial forces, just as in the case of the lower kingdoms. But the evolution of the internal or real man is purely spiritual. First of all, as earlier mentioned, the term astral, as used by HPB, is not the astral of DK Theosophy. For example, the Theosophical Glossary tells us, quote, no natural phenomenon, whether mental, psychic, or physical, can be explained without it. For without it, the physical world would crumble to impalpable dust, talking about astral forces, right? So unlike in DK Theosophy, the astral light is causal to all three levels of the world of form, including the mental. But the Theosophical Glossary also says it is the mother of the physical world, just as Akasha is the mother of the astral light. Akasha is much more than the substance by which records are kept. Quote, it is the active ideation of the universe, producing its ever-changing aspects on the planes of matter. Can we get a reader for this? This should help understand this idea of the astral light.
Lisa, can you read that for us, please? Lisa? Okay, I don't see her unmuting. So Cindy, can you read that for us, please? Thank you.
Yes. There is one great difference between the astral light and the akasha, which must be remembered. The latter is eternal, the former is periodic. The astral light changes not only with the Mahamavarantaras, but also with every sub-period and planetary cycle or round. The akasha is the eternal divine consciousness which cannot differentiate, have qualities, or act. Action belongs to that which is reflected or mirrored from it. The unconditioned and infinite can have no relation with the finite and conditioned. We may compare the akasha as the astral light to the germ in the acorn, the latter besides containing in itself the astral form of the future oak, conceals the germ from which grows a tree containing millions of forms. These forms are contained in the acorn potentially, yet the development of each particular acorn depends upon extraneous circumstances, physical forces, etc.
Okay, so the main point of this is that you have to try to figure out just how HPB is using the term astral, because it's quite different than the way DK uses the term astral, which is very specifically the sixth subplane of the cosmic physical plane, the astral plane, right? And the astrality of HPB is a astral light is an effect of the akasha, the downward penetrating energy that results in the form aspect, right? So it's, in some ways it's less defined in terms of just where it's working from. Okay. Next up, it is now no more a passage of the impersonal monad through many and various forms of matter, endowed at best with instinct and consciousness on quite a different plane, as in the case of external evolution, but a journey of the pilgrim's soul through various states of not only matter, but self-consciousness and self-perception, or of perception from apperception. See, gods, monads, and atoms. So, as in the previous statement, HPB here contrasts the evolution of the form aspect in its journey through the substantive realms and that of the pilgrim's soul through progressive states of self-consciousness. Perception from apperception refers to perception gained through a fully conscious synthetic understanding. That's what apperception means. It's a synthetic understanding that comes through awareness of the enclosing form, right? Of all that is involved. So next, the monad emerges from its state of spiritual and intellectual unconsciousness and, skipping the first two planes, too near the absolute to permit of any correlation with anything at a lower plane, it gets direct into the plane of mentality. This is a reference to the soul aspect sent forth by the monad onto the higher mental plane. The skipped planes are the atmic and buddhic planes. The suggestion made here is that the mental plane is the first plane, counting downwards, able to correlate the monad and the personality she's, which it does through the egoic lotus. Okay. Next, but there is no plane in the whole universe with a wider margin or a wider field of action in its almost endless gradations of perceptive and apperceptive qualities than this plane, which has in its turn an appropriate smaller plane for every form from the mineral monad up to the time when that monad blossoms forth by the evolution into the divine monad. So HPB is here referring to the mental plane, which she observes makes possible an almost endless gradation of, quote, perceptive and apperceptive qualities, which is true. Even as it applies to the human kingdom, there's a near infinite gradation of subtle levels of not only perception, but of consciousness, right? Which is, the word consciousness and apperception are real close, you know, because you have to have greater consciousness to have synthetic perception, which is what apperception is. But curiously, HPP here also includes a place on the mental plane for mineral monads, suggesting that just as the higher human she's exist, even though they are not activated, when a human being has not yet developed those faculties, right? Like a normal personality who functions on the three lower planes, they do have a buddhic and an atmic and a monadic sheaths, but they're unactivated yet. They're unconscious. So just as that exists, so apparently do the higher sheaths of even the lowest kingdoms in nature pre-exist, right? Before they become active. And finally, but all the time, it is still one and the same monad, differing only in its incarnations throughout its ever succeeding cycles of partial or total obscuration of spirit, or the partial or total obscuration of matter, two polar antitheses, as it ascends into the realms of mental spirituality or descends into the depths of materiality. So HPP goes into the statement in depth in an upcoming section, but we can say that, quote, differing only in its incarnations, again, points to a relatively static monad whose evolutional time frame spans an inconceivably longer period than our personality evolution. How are we doing here? Okay, we can do. I think actually this would be a good place to stop because we're not gonna be able to really look into this. So why don't we stop here? And if you could give us dates for the next events.
Okay, so.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Next Friday is your TCF.
Right, Tuesday, Cosmic Fire, right?
Uh-huh.
Which you can sign up for on morifederation.com.
And the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be on 4 June.
Okay.
And all of these are at 7 p.m. GMT. And then the next Secret Doctrine will be on 18 June.
4 weeks. All right, good, good. Okay, any last thoughts or questions? This can be difficult material, but it's very engaging. When you continually go through it, you know, read it again and again, it starts to make sense, and it really develops an amazing picture of you know, how these chains and rounds and globes unfold and what happens during their unfolding. So we will continue next time on this topic. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you, everyone. Good morning, good evening, goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.